Since the territorial area of the Earth is divided among different states, interstate relations must occupy much of a state's time and energy. The natural tendency of a state is to expand its power, and externally such expansion takes place by conquest of a territorial area. Unless a territory is stateless or uninhabited, any such expansion involves an inherent conflict of interests between one set of state rulers and another. Hey, y'all, congratulations by the end of this episode. Had you been watching all the previous episodes related to Anatomy of the State, for all intents and purposes, you've absorbed the whole book. Now, of course, there is a plethora of footnotes you can go back and look through, and I've been linking to the PDF version of the book in case you don't have a physical copy. But for anyone out there listening to this kind of material for the first time, you've taken a huge mental leap. And related to marginal utility and diminishing returns, going from having no knowledge to having some knowledge is a huge step to ultimately what you'll build on from here. So today we're talking about how states relate to one another, and we're also going to talk about how history as a race between state power and social power and how those two relate to each other. And I save these last chapters for last because they're related. And you'll notice I'm always asking my listeners to actively think through these thought experiments because not everything is intuitive, and that's exactly the kind of thing you realize when you study economics and history. An anecdote can be worth a million words or none. So I ask you to think, not assuming you aren't already, but in the different ways I'm describing information to you, try to notice the patterns. So history, of course, has always been the battle between personal liberty and intrusion upon such liberty. And Rothbard notes here that, quote, "We have seen that the internal and domestic attempt to limit the state in the 17th through 19th centuries reached its most notable form in constitutionalism." So there was an attempt to limit the scope of this newly created government in the 18th century, but how did it fare? Well, Murray also notes that, quote, "Parts of the international law were originally purely private, growing out of the need of merchants and traders everywhere to protect their property and adjudicate disputes." So this just goes to show that law and government are mutually exclusive in that laws arise from a body of people that agree on them, whereas no government can have the consent of everybody regarding the laws they impose. And another interesting thing he notes is, but even the governmental rules emerged voluntarily and were not imposed by any international superstate. The object of the laws of war was to limit interstate destruction to the state apparatus itself, thereby preserving the innocent civilian public from the slaughter and devastation of war. Now, the next quote here by F.J.P. Veal, who was an English historian in the 20th century, said of 15th century Italy that the rich burghers and merchants of medieval Italy were too busy making money and enjoying life to undertake the hardships and dangers of soldiering themselves. How about that? So they adopted the practice of hiring mercenaries to do their fighting for them. Now, here's the thing. Normal people who are seeing vast improvements in their life day to day don't want it all blown up in a war. They just don't. Who would want to go to war if things are generally getting better day to day? So you often hear this absurd notion from socialists that capitalism breeds war and vice versa. Well, no, that's not accurate historically or plausibly, because like I described in the last episodes, war is the health of the state and the state is the enemy of capitalism. Now, again, as stated in other episodes, it's really a modern invention that wars are fought between nations of people. Wars until recent centuries were always thought of as irrelevant battles between rulers, between other sets of nobles, or whatever, as Murray put it. And as John Neff stated in his book, War and Human Progress, even postal communications were not successfully restricted for long in wartime. And he goes on to say, "The modern notion hardly existed that the subjects of any enemy country are partly accountable for the belligerent acts of their rulers." Another concept mentioned is the sanctity of treaties, which some may recognize as being one of the peace treaties that helped end World War I. But an important distinction needs to be made between a treaty and a contract, in that they're not the same thing. A contract, as Murray puts it, transfers in a precise manner titles to private property. Since the government does not in any proper sense own its territorial area, any agreements that it concludes do not confer titles to property. Pretty simple. And an example he gives is that, say, Mr. Jones sells land to Mr. Smith. Well, Mr. Jones' offspring can't come around down the line to claim they have a property title to that land. Now, imagine this with a country. I'm quoting here. "But if at a certain date, the government of, say, Ruritania is coerced or even bribed by the government of Moldavia into giving up some of its territory, it is absurd to claim that the governments or inhabitants of the two countries are forever barred from a claim to reunification of Ruritania on the grounds of the sanctity of a treaty." Neither the people nor the land of Northwest Wuritania are owned by either of the two governments. As a corollary, one government can certainly not bind by the dead hand of the past a later government through treaty. A revolutionary government, which overthrew the king of Wuritania, could, similarly, hardly be called to account for the king's actions or debts. For a government is not, as a child, a true heir to its predecessor's property. The last chapter is titled History as a Race Between State Power and Social Power, and it sums up these ideas, but in a different way. And it was Albert J. Nock who termed social power as man's power over nature and the transformation of resources, or power over nature. And state power, being coercive and parasitic, is power over man. So quoting here, through history, man's productive and creative forces have, time and time again, carved out new ways of transforming nature for man's benefit. The fight against the state is the fight to restore everyone's natural rights. All right, well, thanks, everybody. That is the end of Anatomy of the State. Get out, go get a copy of the book, buy someone else a copy of the book, go read it yourself. Donate on Patreon if you can, because I have some big things coming. I have great guests lined up for the next week. So as always, for peace and love. Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.